Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is singer-songwriter Bird. She's just released a new album titled Held Here Together. It features some co-writes with members of Travis, Texas, and Dire Straits, as well as several that she penned on her own, plus a Smiths cover and one from the Bob Dylan songbook as well. We discussed the LP as well as some of the more unusual influences that found their way into the music, plus the recent film that Bird helmed, You Found a Friend in Elvis, which examines a story about Roy Orbison stopping a plot to steal Elvis Presley's body back in 1977. That's Bird on Into Music, coming up now. This kind of represents two EPs and then new material.
Right on.
And when did it occur to you that you wanted to kind of take that approach and put it all together as one thing?
It didn't really occur to me, to be honest. I think it was always an album, but instead of making it and then releasing it, now we can't do that because we have to feed the beast that is the algorithm. So if you don't release music for like a year, everyone thinks you died. So So the only way to do it is to release singles as you go along. So I suppose the upside to that is that people kind of were almost part of the album's development, because every time we released a single, it was kind of part of the writing process. So instead of sort of finishing it off, then slowly choosing the tracks, we just kind of wrote, released until it was a body of work. But it was always meant to be a body of work. And at some point, I think I said to someone how disappointed I was that I felt cheated that I didn't have like my album. And they were like, but you do, just release it anyway. And I was like, well, just so right. Of course I should. So, and the only thing that I did slightly differently is that I went back and revisited some of the earlier mixes and the early mastering, because I wanted it to really sonically feel like a body of work when you listen to it, especially for the vinyl. So I went back in and I revisited a couple of the tracks that were, you know, a year apart from the sort of last track, so that it felt kind of really cohesive, because although they were written, you know, around the same times and with the same kind of intention musically and from a writing point of view, it was quite important to me that sonically people really felt like they were getting a body of work. So we did that.
Yeah, well, it definitely feels that way and sounds that way.
Nice.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about the sequencing, because I feel like I feel like there's a kind of emotional evolution as we go through the album.
Yeah, I guess there is. I mean, when I put the songs together for an album, I'm thinking about the sort of ebb and flow of it and how musically they sit best together in order for the listener to enjoy that and enjoy the kind of ritual of sitting down and listening to a body of work. So I'm maybe less concerned about the storytelling from beginning to end, and I'm more concerned about how that sonically feels to sort of sit there and listen to it, because, you know, there is some merit in considering at what point you want the album to kind of drop down a bit in tempo, at what point you want it to kind of feel exciting again, and that might not necessarily reflect in the stories or the lyrics, but I feel each individual song is its own kind of very personal constructed story. But bearing that in mind, I did choose the first and last songs with the kind of story of it all in mind. And it you know, it starts with a song that has a certain intent, and then it ends, of course, with Things Get Broken. And that was a very deliberate decision to want to end with that, because it really is the resolution of holding something together, isn't it? It's that idea that, you know, things can fall apart, but what do we do to kind of hold them together, even if that just means having faith in something. So it was quite important to me that I ended the album with that kind of warm hug of a thing. So, yeah.
That's always nice, because for me as a listener, it's a point where when I have something, when I hear something like that, that has some sort of resonance with something that came earlier, I go, okay, let's do that again and see what other parts we can kind of put together.
How does it all lock together? I mean, it was every album I've ever made has had a kind of intention at the beginning, and this was no different. And all it was kind of released inside out and kind of back to front. It was still made with the same set of kind of specific intentions. So, you know, I made a whole album just out of voices and cello sounds once called Girl and a Cello. And I made another album where everything had to be played by me. I kind of gave myself the rule that if I didn't play, it couldn't go on the album, which presented a few challenges. I'm not the world's best, I don't know, like electric guitar player. So that, you know, but that was really fun to do. And then with this album, I really intentionally wanted to go back to the roots of being a singer-songwriter again, you know, the kind of whole reason that I kind of started writing in the first place, and to go to some place that felt like really authentic, because, you know, there's so much inauthenticity in the world these days. So that was kind of important to me. And so all of these songs were written with that kind of remit in mind. Like, they never kind of, you know, strayed. So I guess in some ways it doesn't really matter, you know, which order they're released in or how long it took to write from beginning to end, because that sort of keeps it cohesive, the fact that there was that kind of intent in each song as we went along.
Do you remember what it was that made you want to write songs?
At the very beginning of songwriting? Yeah, I sort of do, really. Yeah, I think that it was just that I remember that magical skin-tingling feeling when you hear a song and it connects with some deep, deep, deep part of you. And it's magic. It's actual magic. Like, there's no rhyme or reason. There's no science to explain why that happens, because for each of us, it's different, right, as well. And I still remember as a kind of, not even a teenager, I was probably a tween, and that sort of sucker punch feeling of hearing a piece of music and it just kind of like blowing you away. And from the minute I knew that I was able to be some tiny part of that magic making by being able to play instruments and by being able to write, I was like, I will strive to do that for myself and for other people. I want to give people that feeling, that kind of deep feeling of connection. It felt like the kind of purest, most honest, most beautiful thing in the world. It's sort of like falling in love, isn't it? When you hear a great song or something, not even, it doesn't even have to be a great song, but a song that deeply, profoundly connects with you. Sometimes you can't even explain why. It's just the same as love. It's like sort of creating little moments of love over and over again. I can't think of anything better than doing that, especially for a job, you know?
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because a few years ago, a friend of mine taught at a school for kind of advanced learners, and he put together this evening of first love. So he invited a bunch of us to just write about our first loves. And I wrote about James Taylor's Carolina in my mind, which was the first song that I remember just, you know, being transfixed by. And it was very much that feeling of like, what is this?
Right. Right. It's like there should be like there's a Cupid's arrow, but there should also be kind of little music notes that kind of the same thing, because it really is a very similar kind of sensation, isn't it? It's kind of the beauty of a song sort of hitting your soul in that way, and you realizing, I think it's also just a sense of you're not alone. Do you know what I mean? Like, somebody wrote something, and, you know, they wrote it for you to hear, you know, not specifically, but they did, you know. And all of a sudden you've made that connection with that thing that that person created. It's just a beautiful human thing, isn't it? That's lovely.
Well, I'm sure you've experienced this. Like, you might write a song and you have a very specific idea for it, but you'll hear from a listener or an audience member and they'll say, oh, that, you know, that reminded me of my father, or that reminded me of my son, or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, right. And sometimes people ask me the question, what makes a great song? And my answer is always in part about that, about the fact that a great song should be, you know, have enough meaning for people to kind of, you know, really understand it, but should be in some ways ambiguous enough that you can also, you know, connect your own story to it somehow, you know. Even if the lyrics can feel quite specific, there should be some ambiguity about it that kind of allows you to go, oh yeah, but that, you know, could also be about, you know, my thing. And then it's quite funny, because sometimes, of course, people just totally miss the mark as well. And that tends to be like reviewers, of which there are less and less these days, I have to say. So it doesn't happen as much. But there was a song I wrote many years ago on my first album, and it was called All Shoes Should Cost the Same. And it's the only time, still the only time in my entire career, that I didn't write the lyrics or the title. I wrote the music, but I didn't write the lyrics or the title. And I remember this song, and there was one reviewer, and he just like smashed this. He was just like, "This song is horrendous, typical of a girl to like write about shoes." And it was a guy that wrote the song, and the song was really deep and really personal. It's a beautiful lyric. It's actually a really smart lyric. And this reviewer had like totally missed the mark. He just like analyzed it kind of all wrong. But even that, it's kind of funny, and it kind of amused me, because you realize that, once those words and that music is out in the world, like, you have no control over how that will be interpreted. And that's kind of cool too. It's its own thing once it's left your hands. A lot of songwriters talk about their songs being like kids. They help them sort of grow up when they write them, and then they sort of go off into the world, and it kind of does feels quite true, in some ways.
As I think about that thing of when you write something at, say, a certain age and you've just emerged from a specific situation, and then 20 years later revisiting it, and it's like, oh, I actually was writing about this.
Right on, yeah. You have no idea that you were actually kind of deep down writing about something else. Yeah, I guess that's kind of true. I do look at some of my earlier work now, and I see that I was hiding a lot behind sort of, other metaphors and maybe bits of other people's stories, but it's actually a lot more personal than I like to think it is. I was just too young to understand how to sort of express that well for myself, so I sort of, snuck it in all these other ways. So yeah.
Tell me about the car on this album, which I love because I think this is a good example of where the writing and production and performance really all kind of coalesce into making something really powerful.
Yeah, thank you. And well, I wrote that one myself, and I wrote it in that crazy COVID time. I got stuck in Italy in this like mad lockdown, because Italy kind of like properly locked down. It was kind of mad, and I didn't have any of my instruments or anything with me. So I went online. I managed to get Amazon to deliver a kid's ukulele, a desk mic, and a mini MIDI keyboard. And I just spent like 52 days locked in this house. So I wrote a whole bunch of real crazy stuff, and most of that is never going to see the light of day. But a couple of tracks survived and made it on the album. One is a car, and the other one is the film, which is also on the album. But the car was really because I started listening to a lot of my old favorite songs during that period as well. And one of them is Warm Leatherette by The Normal. And that guy is also the guy that went on to Daniel Miller, when he went on to form Mute Records. Kind of a cool dude. And I've always loved that track. And it was something about the kind of dystopic reality where we're in at that moment in time. And Warm Leatherette, for your listeners, if they've never heard it, it's pretty out there. And then I was like, God, I really want to write my own Warm Leatherette, And then I thought about how, relationships and car crashes, car crash is a good metaphor for a sort of messed up relationship. And so I wanted to sort of write a song from that angle, using it as a metaphor, but a sort of homage as well to Warm Leatherette, which I really love. And it was quite a tricky one, because I wrote it really quickly and really easily, because I did that one myself. But then the recording process, the kind of getting the production to where I wanted, that actually took a really long time, because I wrote it in a really weird way, and I loved some of the quirk of it, and I didn't want to lose that, but I didn't want it to kind of drop in production value or feel kind of weaker compared to the other songs. But I also didn't want to over orchestrate it just for the sake of it, because that's a terrible thing to do to a song. So it did took me a good while to get that one born. It was a little bit of a trickier birth than some of the others, but I'm glad that I stuck with it, and I'm glad that I didn't go with the first version. I'm glad that I sort of gave myself the time and space to get it right, because I'm happy with it now. So yeah.
Warm Leatherette, I would have never guessed.
Right, it's quite a leap from when you hear the car, which is good. It would be worrying if it sounded exactly the same, but now that you do know, it kind of makes sense. It's like, oh, right, yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah, I'll have to program them back to back and see if anybody picks up on that.
Car crash songs.
Yeah. Well, you also do How Soon Is Now? Tell me about the decision to cover that tune.
I was a fairly big Smiths fan when I was younger, and I used to play. I started off playing that live years and years ago. I stuck it in the live set kind of cover of it, and it was just really popular. People used to kind of love listening to it, but it never fitted to put it on an album before. Like, it just, I always thought about putting it on, and I was like, no, it doesn't sit with the rest of the songs. Like, and if I record something, it really, like I said, there has to be this kind of intent. And then, so when I decided to do this kind of singer-songwriter album, I was like, well, no, this is my moment to be able to put on a couple of covers, sort of pay tribute to some songs that, really informed me as a writer. And so I finally got the chance to do it. And I did two versions of it because I just couldn't quite decide which way I wanted to go with it. So I thought, you know what, I'll just do both. So there's a sort of big orchestra version of it, and then there's this kind of very cool Texas band version that I think is the version that's on the album. Yeah, the Austin, Texas version. And I'm very happy with that because it sort of just came out of a jam. So it felt really fun to put a song on there that had that vibe to it, because a lot of songwriting starts like that, starts as a sort of a jam of an idea, and then before you know it, you're like, oh, maybe this has legs, maybe I can work with this. But yeah, it's one of my favorite songs, and I actually managed to get it to Johnny Marr to listen to, and it got his blessing. He said that he really liked it. So yeah, he didn't post that, unfortunately, on his socials. That would have been amazing. But I did get an email from his manager saying that he'd listened to it and that he liked it a lot. So there you go. Johnny Marr approved. Yeah.
There you go. And that's an interesting one too, because I find that people who say that they don't like the Smiths like that song.
It's a bit, I mean, it's a bit different to stuff like Girlfriend in a Coma, isn't it? It's got a different vibe to it. It almost doesn't really feel like the Smiths, I suppose, in some ways. Yeah, maybe I'll put a more Smith sounding Smith song in our album. It's not the first time I covered a Smith song. I actually did, thinking about it now, I did cover a Smith song before, and I covered Some Girls Are Bigger Than Others, and I did it on the album that I made called Girl in a Cello, that I made entirely from sounds I could make out of a cello and voice. And I changed the lyrics to Some Boys Are Bigger Than Others because I like that, I like the double entendre of that. And when I did it, the label actually made me record both versions because they were like, you need to get the permission of the writer if you change the lyric, obviously. And they were like, there's no way Morrissey will agree to that. And I was like, yeah, I'll be fine. And actually, he did agree to it. He thought it was really funny. So I've had two Smiths band members like not trash my work. I also have had some pretty furious Smith fans, though. Not weirdly, not the Some Boys song. They didn't mind that at all. But How Soon Is Now, there were a couple of like furious Smith fans who like posted on like YouTube, going, how dare you? How dare you cover? You've ruined it. So, but I find all that kind of vaguely amusing because, the whole point of covering a song is that you're showing your respect for how much you love the song. And also, you have to make it your own. Like, if you cover a song and just make it sound exactly like theirs, then it'd be pointless. Like, there's like no point. In some ways, I like to think that maybe I open up, a whole new bunch of potential Smith fans, people who'd never heard of them before. They hear my version and they're like, who was that? And then they go and check out the Smiths and then they go, oh, they're brilliant. So, I'm trying to sort of extend their fan club. But anyway, any which way, they weren't very happy with me. A few of them, most of them loved it. Most of them loved it. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, if you could just get them to reunite.
I like that.
Things that will never happen for 100. And of course, Lay Lay Lay. And I have this thing with Bob Dylan that I love when there is a woman covering a Bob Dylan song, because I always feel like there's another layer that emerges through the songs, because I think that he has this feminine quality that people miss sometimes just in his performance and songwriting.
Yeah, that's very astute. And I would have to agree with that. Yeah, I think part of the reason that I feel able to connect with him is because there is this kind of feminine undertone. And he's the master of that kind of ambiguity that we were talking about as well. There's like solid songwriting in there, but everybody can make a connection to it as well. Actually, I know this isn't true now, but there was a little period when somebody told me that Lay Lady Lay was actually about his dog. And they said it in such a convincing way. And they were American, so that made me feel more sure that it was true. I don't know why. Like, I just trusted the American accent. I was like, oh, maybe that's right then. And then for a little while there, I was telling people at gigs, I think this might be about his dog. And then someone said to me, oh my God, that's so not true, Jamie. Like, I don't know anymore why you believe that. So, yeah, I knocked that one on the head quite quickly and did a bit of research and found out that, yeah, that probably isn't true. But I think you're right. I think he does have this sort of lovely feminine kind of quality to his writing too. And I think that he's very generous as a writer. He allows a lot of space for other people to interpret as well. And that's a skill that is not often seen. You only really see that in the great writers. There's a reason why they're that popular, you know, and he does that really well.
Yeah. Put a stamp on it, but not too much of a stamp.
Somehow, yeah, it's really smart the way he does it.
Yeah. Kind of last thing. Tell me about this film, You Found a Friend in Elvis.
Yeah, I'm an accidental filmmaker. It started out because I made a bunch of work during COVID and it didn't get the sort of release and get finished the way it was meant to. Actually, it is now finished. But at the time, you know, I said, I don't know what I'm going to do with this. And some friends went, oh, you know, it's so cinematic. You should put it in a film. Anyway, long story short, I ended up writing a short film and that music went in that film. And it did really sort of well. I'd never made a short film before, so I didn't know what to expect. And it won some awards and it got in a bunch of festivals. And so after that, people kept asking me, when are you going to make another short film? And I was like, well, I don't make anything unless I have an intention, you know, like if there's a reason for it. So I don't have a reason right now. And then I watched this documentary about Roy Orbison, and it was from the perspective of his three living sons. It was really beautiful. And in it, Roy Jr. tells this story about his dad being amazing friends with Elvis, so much so that when Elvis's dead body was going to be stolen by a group of thieves, Roy found out about the plot, was going to get in his car, grab a gun, and save the body. And it was like so British, so BBC, that it just like cut something else. And I was like, what's the craziest story I've ever heard? So I wrote a song about it because it just inspired me. I was like, imagined, you know, the whole kind of scenario. And I wrote this song. And then somebody said to me, you know, at a show, they were like, is that true? And I was like, oh, I don't know. And then another friend said, well, there's your second film. You should go and find out. So that's what I did. So I went to the States and I made this short documentary. It's just 11 minutes and just finding out if that story was true or not. And it's, you know, it's a fun little short. And the spoiler alert is that it's half of the story is totally true, which blew my mind that even half of it was true, to be honest with you. And it was a lot of fun making it. And it was an interesting one because I really wanted to have Roy Jr.'s voice in it. And, you know, people were like, there's no way you'll never get hold of, you know, somebody from the Orbison family. And I was like, oh. So I kind of, you know, I tried and I tried and I tried. And eventually a friend managed to get the song to Roy Jr. And he heard the song and he called me up and said that it had made him cry. I think in a good way. And so he was really supportive and really sweet and let me use his voice in my short film. And yeah, it was beautiful. You know, I got to make this connection with somebody who was related to somebody I wrote a song about. So that was sort of beautiful too. So, and the film's still showing. It's at festivals. It's been selected for a few in the States. The last one was last month, the Lighthouse Festival in Long Island, New York. So we're just waiting to see where the next ones are going to be. But every now and again, it makes its way onto some screen somewhere, which is really nice as well. So that's the fun thing about short film. You never know where it's gonna end up. So, yeah.
You've been listening to a conversation with Bird. The new Bird album, Held Here Together, is out now. You can find out more about Bird at her official website, birdofficial.com. That includes information about her filmmaking, in addition to her writing, recording, and touring activities. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website,
KMUW.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@KMUW.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, we'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson.